Welcome to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Talk about stuff that's messing with your head and crazy stuff that's happening in the bed. Why? Because many church folks have fallen into darkness. The Bible calls us to walk as children of light. The Bible says, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Ladies and gentlemen, happy Thanksgiving to you. If this is the first time that you're hearing this broadcast, this is Thanksgiving, and so happy Thanksgiving to you. But if it's not the first time, if this is a rebroadcast of this program, still be thankful. You should still have an attitude of gratitude. You know, at my office there at the church, I have a Bible verse that says, in everything, give thanks, for this is the will of God concerning your life. Yeah. In everything. Whatever the situation is. Not for everything, but in everything. You don't thank the Lord that your house burned down. No. But in spite of your house burning down this year, give thanks. Give thanks, because God is up to something great. See, some of you got a better house now as a result of your house burning down. See, some of you got better clothes now as a result of your house catching on fire. So, in everything, give thanks, for this is the will of God concerning your life. Now, one of the things that we in America really need to give thanks for is that we have a great country. It's a good country. Now, any country gonna have problems, but I wouldn't want to live nowhere else but in America. To tell you the truth, I wouldn't want to live nowhere else but in America, because America is a good Christian nation. Now, most people today, they are trying to rewrite history. And they are saying that America is not a Christian nation. America, you know, it never was a Christian nation, never was founded on Christian principles and things like that. Well, the America that I know, and the history that I know, was founded on Christian principles. We didn't have, America didn't have a lot of different religions from different countries and stuff like we have today. We got, you know, the Middle Eastern people that are, most of them are Muslim. We got the Eastern religions today, and a lot of them are Hindu people and Buddhist people. And so you got a bunch of different kind of religions today, and they are trying to minimize, downplay American religion. But you know, when you go into other countries, you have to believe whatever that other country believes. So if you go into China and Russia, they don't believe in no God, and so they don't want you to believe in God over there. If you go to Saudi Arabia, you got to be Muslim, and if you try to convert people, that's death penalty. But in America, we let you believe whatever you want to believe. Now, that's good in one sense, but it's bad in another sense, because they are trying to downplay and minimize our Christian heritage. And so today, I wanted us to go back, and I wanted us to look at some evidence of America being a Christian nation when it was founded. So, one of the great historians to me is David Barton. So get close to your radio and listen as David Barton teaches.
The Bible tells us that the way that a people views its history will always affect the way that that people behaves. That's why the scripture in so many places tells us to recall the former days, to remember the former times. God wants us to know our history. That's a big emphasis that he has throughout. It's significant that today in many ways we've moved away from that. And we know little about our own history. And therefore we know little about why we exist as a nation we do today. Now, there's no question that we're a different nation from others in the sense that when 2 weeks from now we have our 4th of July celebration, at that point in time we will have set another world's record, literally. We will have 239 years under the same piece of paper. No other government can say that. And by the way, this year there are 195 different nations at the United Nations. And that number goes up and down every year. Jesus said there'd be wars and rumors of wars. It was that way when he left. It'll be that way until he gets back. Every year those numbers change. But this year with 195 nations, if you look at America, we've had one form of government since 1789. Take any other country and look at how often they've had turmoil and instability, how many revolutions they've had in a relatively short period. Go to any continent, go across the world, and look at what's normal. You see, we're so used to stability that we think that that's normal because that's what we have. That's not normal. What we enjoy is not normal. If you're 95 years old today and you live in Poland, you have lived through seven revolutions and seven different constitutions. If you're a baby boomer in South Korea, you've already lived through six constitutions as a baby boomer. I mean, can you imagine going through every 10 years, every 20 years, every generation, you've got a new constitution, a new revolution? See, we don't think like that. We've been blessed with stability. We've also been blessed with creativity. America has only 4% of the world's population. Now, our little 4%, when you look every year at discoveries and medical inventions and symphonies and you look at technology, whatever, our 4% every year produces more than the other 96% of the world combined. 4% of the world's population ought to produce 4% of the world's whatever, not in America. Our 4% produces more than the 96% does, and the same thing when it comes to prosperity. Our 4% of the world's population produces 25% of the world's gross domestic product. Now, we don't produce more because we have more, because that's certainly not the case. There are many more continents and nations that have greater natural resources than we do, but we're just able to take what we have and make it produce more than other nations. We've been exceptional in this way, and you know, a lot of people, I'm very involved in academics. I'm appointed by a number of governors and state boards of education to do social studies standards in those states. So I see what we teach in our textbooks, and we don't teach anything to be proud of in America today. We really work hard to say America really is the source of all the world's evils, and that's why I've got people going across the world apologizing for America, because that's what we teach. We know if you don't think America is a special nation, then you don't think the sun comes up in the east and goes down in the west, because you're denying self-evident facts, whether it's statistics like these or so many other categories. And that's what we no longer get exposed to today. But when you look at all this that we have, all these blessings that we enjoy, if you had looked into textbooks even 50 years ago, and you can still do that now, go to the library and look into textbooks 50 years ago, you will find that 50 years ago, when we talked about what made America special in so many areas, we consistently told students that, well, the reason America is different is because of the Bible. We pointed to the Bible. Now, of course, we don't do that today. We go exactly the opposite direction. I was involved with the state recently in doing their history standards, and when we got to the civil rights movement in the 1960s, we're talking about Dr. Martin Luther King, and I said, let's make sure that we say he's the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, because he was pastor of a church. Said, oh no, we can't put that in there. Wait a minute, wasn't he a pastor? Yeah, but we can't say that. What do you mean you can't say that? That's history. You should be able to say. I said, you just put in here that you want the students to read the letter from a Birmingham jail, and you're not going to tell the students that was a pastor writing to the other pastors in the community saying, what are you doing sitting on the sideline? You got to get in. You're not going to say it. We can't say that. Really? See, we've gone so far that not only do we not say the Bible is the source of why we have these blessings, we won't even talk about the people who use the Bible to change the culture. We go in the other direction. But even with all that, it is still really easy today to prove that the Bible has a huge impact on who we are, even now. Just the way we talk to one another. Do you know that we have 257 idioms in the Bible? Of idioms in our language that come directly from the Bible. I mean, these phrases you hear every day, and they're all direct quotes out of the Bible. 257, you recognize these, by the skin of your teeth. I'll give you my 2 cents worth. A leper can't change his spots. There's nothing new under the sun. Signs of the time, a thorn in the flesh, cradle to the grave, handwriting on the wall, a fly in the ointment. You go through 257 phrases we use on a daily basis or Bible quotations. That's how much the Bible influences just the way we talk to one another. Now, if you want to have a lot of fun, next time you're out and you go to, I don't know, Walmart, or you go to Lowe's or Home Depot, or you go to Macy's, whatever, you'll hear somebody use one of those 257 phrases. And when you hear them use that, you ought to stop them right there and say, hey, do you know what Bible verse you just quoted? Now, of course, they won't have a clue, but the problem is they're going to look at you and say, no, I don't. What Bible verse was that? And we won't have a clue either. So, you know, as Christians, we don't even know where this stuff came from. Every one of these has an address. Every one of these Bible verses you see right there. And see, I think where we are today is very accurately described by President John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams said this. He said, with regard to the history contained in the Bible, it's not so much praiseworthy to be acquainted with it as it is shameful to be ignorant of it. See, we've come to a point in American history where we've had a cultural default. Today, if you had recognized the addresses for those idioms, we would have praised you, said, I can't believe that you knew that. That is so cool that you knew that. And back in their day, they would have said, whoa, you didn't know that came out of the Bible? How call yourself an educated person and not have read the greatest book in the history of the world? See, the cultural default is exactly opposite. That everybody knew that back then. Today, very few people know that. There's also a great quote from President Teddy Roosevelt. And by the way, for the next few minutes, I'm going to use several presidents of the United States. And I do this specifically because you would expect me, expect Pastor Steve, you expect us to say good things about the Bible. But you don't expect that for 150 years in American history, it was the presidents of the United States who carried the water on the Bible. They're the ones who kept telling Americans, guys, you got to have the Bible. We can't survive without the Bible. The Bible is what made us. I mean, it was the presidents who kept reminding us about the importance of the Bible. Teddy Roosevelt said this. He said, the teachings of the Bible are so interwoven and so entwined with our civic and our social life. Notice he did not say spiritual life. That was a given. We knew the Bible is the basis of spiritual life. He said the Bible is so much a part of our civic and our social life, it would be impossible for us to figure what life would be if these teachings were removed. According to Teddy, if you take out of America the institutions and the culture that the Bible built, you wouldn't even recognize America. What are you talking about? Well, here's a great example. I mentioned that free market economic system. People today in universities often say that, well, the father of the free market system is Adam Smith. He wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776 that birthed the free market system. Wrong. America had a free market system nearly 100 years before Adam Smith wrote that book. So where did we get our free market system? Historically, the American free market system, which is so different from many other nations' free market system, our free market system was built on five Bible verses. 1 Timothy 5:8, 2 Thessalonians 3:10, Matthew 20, Luke 19, Matthew 25. We knew that. If you take our economic system away, you wouldn't recognize America today, but it was built on the Bible. So what Teddy says, you wouldn't even recognize America if it was gone. Another example. There are seven different forms of human government that exist, and the Bible mentions all seven forms of human government. The Bible specifically prefers one form of government and recommends one form of government, and that's the one the Founding Fathers adopted. It's called a Republican form of government. The Founding Fathers said, we got that out of Exodus 18:21, out of Deuteronomy 1:15, out of Deuteronomy 16:18. They point to the Bible verses where we adopted a Republican form of government. To this day, Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution requires that every state maintain a Republican form of government, not a Democratic form. We're not a democracy. That's one form of government in the Bible. We're a republic. That democracy thing you find over in Luke, you find another example of in Judges 17. We're not a democracy. We're a republic, and that's our form of government that came out of the Bible. You take away our Republican form of government that we have, you wouldn't recognize America. See, that's what he's talking about. He said, we're not talking about spiritual stuff. We're talking about civic and social stuff. It's so much built on the Bible. If you remove it, you wouldn't recognize America. You also have President Franklin Roosevelt who said this. Franklin Roosevelt said, in the formative days of the Republic, the directing influence the Bible exercised on the Father's nation is conspicuously evident, unless you go to school today and it's conspicuously absent. We're not told that at all. He continued, he said, we cannot read the history of our rise and development as a nation without reckoning with the place the Bible has occupied in shaping the advances of the Republic. He said, there's no way you can read American history and not see what the Bible did. Now again, you can today, but even in his generation, that was an impossibility. And again, notice that it's presidents who are telling us how important, if anything went right in America, it was because of the Bible. Let me show you an example of what he's talking about, how you can't read history without seeing the influence of the Bible. Let me take you to this founding father, Ben Franklin. Now, we have about 250 founding fathers, and Franklin is certainly one of the five least religious founding fathers. But Ben Franklin is the first guy in our history to call for the United States of America. Back in 1754, he came up with what was called the Albany Plan of Union that says, hey, let's not be 13 colonies, let's be the United States. Now, it didn't get done at that point in time, but that was his lifelong objective and goal. And so 22 years later, he's one of the 56 guys who signs the Declaration of Independence. That's the first step toward us becoming the United States of America. He's liking this. 7 years later, he's one of only three guys to sign the peace treaty to end the American Revolution and make us an independent nation. Now we're getting really close to having this United States of America. And then 4 years later, he's sitting at the Constitutional Convention making it happen. He's there to help create the United States of America. Now, Franklin is right here, and you see Franklin, he's 81 years old, and he's the old man of the convention by far. Now, I know that's not impressive today, 81, because the average lifespan in America is 80 today. So we know people live in their 80s and 90s and up to 100. Yeah, but back then, do you know what the average lifespan was when they signed the Constitution of the United States? It was 33 years old was the average lifespan. Which means if you happen to be a senior in high school and you're in here this morning and you'd been alive back then, you would have already had your midlife crisis. I mean, once you hit 18, it's way over. You're way past halfway when you hit 18. 81 years old. Franklin's loving this, helping create the, he's wanted the United States of America for 33 years. At least he was initially loving it. He wasn't loving it 5 weeks into it. You see, all the states came with their own agenda. They came to create the United States, but you had the Virginia plan, you had the Connecticut plan, you had the New York plan, you had the New Jersey plan. Of course, the guys from New Jersey loved the New Jersey plan, but they didn't want the New York plan. New York guys didn't want the Virginia plan. The Virginia guys didn't want the Connecticut plan. And so everybody came with their own agenda. And so 5 weeks into this stuff, into the convention, there's so much bickering and fighting going on, the delegates are now starting to leave. Alexander Hamilton, New York, he's out of here. He's tired of all the fighting and bickering. He's got better stuff to do. George Mason, Virginia, he's gone because he's just tired of fighting. At that point, Franklin rises to give the longest speech he gave at the convention. It was on Thursday, June the 28th, 1787. I want you to see what Ben Franklin told the other delegates as he's watching this thing fall apart before his eyes. He said, gentlemen, in this situation of this assembly, groping, as it were, in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding? He said, in the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. A little time out here. This is the identical room in which 11 years earlier they had signed the Declaration of Independence. Back then we had the Continental Congress, and it was one Congress. We didn't have a House and Senate. We had one Congress, and they had two chaplains, and they did a ton of praying. Franklin says, guys, don't you remember what we used to do in this room? We prayed all the time. He said, and our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. He said, all of us engaged in this struggle must have observed frequent instances, of a superintending providence in our favor. He said, and have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? He said, I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. He said, if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain that build it. He said, I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel, and we shall become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business. May I point out that's not bad for your least religious founding father. He has just chewed the other guys out for not praying enough. And that's your least religious founding father. But here's what I want you to see. Franklin, in this little speech you just saw, that speech is 14 sentences long. Here's the question I've got for you. How many Bible verses did you just see Ben Franklin quote in that speech? The answer is 14 Bible verses. You should have seen these verses right here because these are the verses Franklin just quoted. And yet today, if Christians recognize these, we praise them. I can't believe you saw those verses. I didn't see those verses. See, today Christians don't see that, but back in his day, he's the least religious founding father, and he's quoting the Bible like that. See, this is the deal where today to know the Bible is praiseworthy. Back then, even the least religious knew the Bible better than we know the Bible today. See, that's a cultural shift we have. And by the way, the rest of the story is after Franklin's call, they agreed to take 3 days off, kind of like a cooling off period. He'll just back away for a little while. And George Washington, in his diary, said that in those 3 days, they attended church and listened to patriotic orations. So they're at church for these days, and while they're there, the Reverend William Rogers has a special prayer over the Constitutional Convention. Now, I actually own the prayer that he prayed. We're very blessed in our organization. We own 100,000 documents from before 1812. So I own thousands of documents from George Washington, Adams, Jefferson, these thousands of documents out of black history and out of church history and out of judicial history and out of educational history. Got all these documents, and we have the prayer that he prayed over the Constitutional Convention. And it was not a dinky little civic prayer like God bless this gathering. I mean, he had the Constitutional Convention there in front of him, and he took time and he prayed a prayer over that. Everybody in the city knew it was falling apart. They knew all the trouble going on. He prayed a prayer, and that prayer was actually printed on the front page of the newspaper because everybody in the city knew the trouble was there. And when you read that prayer, it's not up in a little corner. It takes 3/4 of the front page of the newspaper, the prayer he prayed over the Constitutional Convention. They get back from that time of prayer, and delegates like Jonathan Dayton said the whole atmosphere had changed. That was a really dumb idea last week, but that's a pretty reasonable idea. They started changing and cooperating and started thinking through things. And so they go from 5 weeks of fighting, bickering, literally falling apart at the convention, to only 10 weeks later to come out with the document under which we now govern ourselves. We're the longest ongoing constitutional republic in the history of the world. And if you know the Bible, and if you read the Constitution, you find Bible verses and Bible precepts all over that document. And yet today we're regularly told, oh no, the Constitution is a godless document. As a matter of fact, there's a book out by two professors from Cornell University, Kramnik and Moore, and the name of the book is A Godless Constitution. When somebody today tells me the Constitution is godless, what they have actually told me is that they are biblically illiterate. They wouldn't recognize a Bible verse if it bit them in the ankle because there's Bible verses all over there, and they just don't recognize it. See, this is the heritage we have, and it was such an obvious heritage that even if you take a president like Andrew Jackson, who's one of our least religious presidents, even for Andrew Jackson, it was a no-brainer. Andrew Jackson says the Bible is the rock on which our republic rests. Everybody knew that and agreed. Not today. Man, everybody said, oh no, Bible had nothing to do with secular beginnings. But when you look back to the founding, and you look back to the base that was built, these are the 56 guys that signed the National Birth Certificate that we're going to celebrate in 2 weeks. 4th of July, we'll celebrate what these 56 guys did. And the first time these guys ever got together is recorded in the records of Congress. Article 1, Section 5, Paragraph 3 of the Constitution requires everything said on the floor of the House and Senate be recorded in public records so that we, the people, can read it. So you can go back and you'll see the first day we have Congress, September the 7th, 1774. And as you read in the records of Congress, you'll see that Congress opened with prayer. You continue to read and you say, whoa, that wasn't a dinky little prayer, was it? No, according to historical records, the opening prayer session in Congress ran for right at 2 hours. That's an interesting way to open Congress, a couple hours of prayer. And they didn't just pray. John Adams said that they also studied 4 chapters of the Bible that morning. John Adams said that he wrote his wife Abigail and said God so spoke to them in that Bible study, so built their faith through what they read in Psalm 35 that they believed they could win the conflict. And so he writes Abigail about Psalm 35. He says, Abigail, I must beg you to read that psalm. Read the 35th psalm to your friends. Read it to your father. Abigail, you got to see what God showed us this morning about the 35th psalm. So Abigail, I want you to read it. I want your friends to read it. I want your father. Her father was the pastor of their church, Reverend William Smith. And when he gets it, he's going to show it to the congregation. John Adams wants everybody to know what God showed them that morning in Psalm 35. But he didn't stop there. He said, Abigail, he says, we've appointed a continental fast. He said, millions will be up on their knees at once before their great creator, imploring his forgiveness and blessings. It smiles on American counsel and arms. He said, can you imagine the impact of having 3 million Americans pray and fast? Now, that time of prayer was the first of 15 times that the Continental Congress called the nation to times of prayer. And those times of prayer alternated as it did here. They start with a time of prayer and fasting. But after you pray and fast, 3 million people praying and fasting, God starts answering the prayers. And so what they have next is a time of prayer and thanksgiving. And then after all the time, prayer and thanksgiving, more difficulty comes up. And so they go back and say, well, we need to pray and fast. So 15 times it goes from prayer and fasting to thanksgiving, to prayer and fasting to thanksgiving, to prayer. 15 times in the American Revolution. By the way, these guys were so into prayer that by the time you get to 1815, there had been 1,400 government-issued calls to prayer in America by 1815. I mean, prayer was a big deal, and officials calling for prayer was a big deal. Where's this secular nation stuff we're told about today? Not by a long shot. But go back to this first day of prayer and fasting. About 6 weeks later, John Adams, in his writings, he says, Abigail, you remember that time of prayer? And he writes, he says, you remember that time of prayer and fasting we had? He says, you're not going to believe what's happening. He starts writing down all these things that happened that just were inexplicable. For example, he said, we just captured a 20-gun British man of war and a 64-gun British man of war. Now, that's really remarkable considering we had no Navy. So we're already, well, I can't say we had no Navy. We did have a Navy. If you ever want to see the American Navy, go to the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., go up on the third floor, and you can see the American Navy. It's a rowboat with a cannon in each end. This is the gunboat Philadelphia right there. I guess when we attacked British ships, it kind of looked like this, you know. Oh, boy, the British are scared to death of us. He says, Abigail, we captured a 20-gun British man of war, 64-gun British man of war. He said, and Colonel Smith and a group of his men just captured a British fort. So what? The American military is supposed to capture forts. I got two kids serving in the Army. They're supposed to take care of the enemy. Now, you got to understand, back then, we were British citizens. We didn't have our own army. We're trying to build one. We're trying to build our own Navy, too. And so the way we built our army, and if there's any officers here, no disrespect, but back then, the way we did officers in the Continental Army was, if you could get a bunch of your neighbors to enlist with you, you got to be the colonel in that group. So when it says, Colonel Smith and a group of his men just captured a British fort, what Adams has really said is Farmer Smith and a bunch of his neighbors have just captured a British fort because it's a guy and his neighbors. And he looks at that and says, Abigail, he said, this is a... So what did he think was happening? Seeing all these inexplicable things. This is what John Adams said. He says...
All right, we're going to have to stop the tape right there today. We'll pick right back up there tomorrow. God bless you. Thank you so kindly for joining us. Listen to us all day long because we're in your corner. Right here on Ghostbusters.